WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest was sentenced to die in prison. Now he practices journalism behind bars. Wilbert Rideau is the editor of The Angleite, the official news magazine of the Louisiana State Penitentiary, one of the nation's biggest maximum security prisons. Under Rideau's leadership, The Angleite has won several major journalism awards. The magazine tackles volatile issues such as prison rape, overcrowding, and the politics of parole. One article, which documented how the electric chair caused a prolonged and agonizing death, led the prison to change its method of execution to lethal injection. A new collection of articles from The Angleite has just been published called Life Sentences, Rage and Survival Behind Bars. The pieces were written by Rideau and his former co-editor, Ron Wickberg. Wilbert Rideau has been in the penitentiary since 1961, when he committed armed robbery and murdered a female bank teller in cold blood. He spent 11 years on death row. His sentence was commuted to life in 1972, when the Supreme Court declared the death penalty unconstitutional. The State Pardons Board has recommended several times that he be paroled. Two governors have turned down the recommendations. We spoke with Rideau from the office of the news magazine, and he told us prison life is different from how it's usually depicted in movies.
It's about routine. It's about carbon-copied nothingness. That's your existence, and you have to... Your entire existence is dedicated to trying to weave meaning into that, because every morning you wake up, you have to justify your existence to yourself. You know, because people in prison live for the same reasons you live. I mean, the same things that they have their dreams, they have their desires, they have their needs, and prison is all about deprivation. It's all about pain, misery, and suffering. And you know, the present is an intolerable situation. So the only thing that keeps you going is the hope of tomorrow, which is the same thing that keeps everybody in the world going, you know, when they're dissatisfied with their present. And that's what it's all about. You're living on hope, and you've got to find reason to hope.
I imagine the magazine helps you keep going, too.
It does. First of all, it rescues me from prison routine. The journalistic world, my job is unpredictable from day to day. I'll wake up tomorrow morning. I can't tell you today what I'll be doing tomorrow morning. Tomorrow I may have something scheduled, but something else pops up. That's the way it goes. So it allows me to escape that deadening, that spirit-deadening routine of prison that most prisoners are locked into.
One of the stories in Life Sentences is about the man who was the executioner at Angola.
Sam Jones.
Yeah, and you interviewed him, and I want to read something that he said to you about the people who he kills or killed. He's no longer the executioner. He said, "They're trash, pure trash. If they was any good, they wouldn't be in the spot where they're at. I don't care whether they're male or female, black or white. It makes no difference. When I strap them in the chair and the warden gives me the nod, I'll push the button. I don't care who it is. You can tell they're scared. They got fear in their eyes, but most of them keep up the macho thing. They all say they're going home. I don't care where they're going, but I'm sending them there."
That's Sam. But in addition to that, you know, we asked Sam about, where are the restrictions on what he do? I mean, you're talking about an individual, and this is what, you know, what we were interviewing him for, is this peculiar ability he has to kill people. You know, you talk about murderers, you talk about people who kill people. Most of the time, people, ordinary citizens, kill other people as it's the result of crime of passion, it's arguments, it's a criminal act, robbing somebody, but Sam Jones is a different breed. You're talking about a society hiring or retaining the ultimate killer to do its dirty deed for him. And here's a man who has this peculiar ability to kill like few people in life have. And he thinks nothing of it, doesn't mean anything to him. And we ask him, what about you? What about your grandson? He had a grandson. So we ask him, what about your grandson? What about your kids? He said, hey, he'd do it to them too. Doesn't make any difference to him. So there are no, even the family bond doesn't restrict his killing ability.
After you wrote this portrait of him, the prison let him go, and he was no longer their executioner. Were they upset by how cold and kind of crazy he sounded in this profile?
They will never acknowledge that publicly, but they have a problem with his, the way he comes across to the public. He's too talkative, and he says things that, probably would disturb the public.
Now, you spent 11 years on death row. What was it like for you to talk to somebody who was the executioner?
It was a weird experience, because I was very mindful of that. You know, when we were standing there talking to him and asking him about his craft and what he did, I was very mindful of the fact that this was the man who would have killed me. And my co-author, Ron Whitberg, and myself, we were talking to him, and, you know, sometimes Ron would go on and talk to him, and I'd be just, I don't know, it's like I was awed, just because it was weird. It's so bizarre. And I don't know how to explain it to you. It's just kind of unreal. You know, I just watched him and looked at him, and, you know, I guess I was more curious about him than he would have ever been about me.
Well, it sounds like he would have felt nothing if you were in the chair.
It's true. But then I'm looking at a guy, at least, you know, I did an awful thing in life. You know, I killed somebody, something which I'll forever regret. And, you know, I'll always try to make amends for in the ways that I can, try to correct it. I know I can't, but at least I try. And that affected me and my life and everything and all the lives that my life touched for as long as I exist. But here's an individual who, it doesn't affect him. It doesn't mean anything to him. Taking life, I mean, killing people meant absolutely nothing to him.
My guest is Wilbert Ritto, and he is the editor of The Angolite, which is the bimonthly news magazine of Angola State Prison, which is a maximum security prison in Louisiana. And there's a new collection of his writings. It's called Life Sentences. It's just been published by Times Books. You know, you brought up what you're in prison for. Can I ask you a little bit about your own story? How old were you when you...
I just made 19 years old. I just become 19 when I killed someone during a bank robbery. That was 31 years ago. Half the world's population wasn't even born then. I was sentenced to death. And while on death row, you know, I wanted to, I don't know, it's, while what I did was, you know, what I did was awful. I mean, it wasn't awful just to others who looked at me. It was awful to me. I mean, when I came to grips with what I'd done, I wanted to undo it. I mean, it's a horrible thing to do. And I was ashamed, and I wanted to correct it. But the problem with taking somebody's life is how do you repay it? You can't.
You spent 11 years on death row. Can you describe what death row was like physically? What it looked like? What your cell was like?
It was a 6x8 cell. We all lived in individual cells, solitary confinement. 6x8 cells, and at that time they would let us out of the cell twice a week for 15 minutes, during which time you had to take a shower, wash your clothes, shave, or do whatever you had to do during that 15-minute period, twice a week. You know, people are social creatures. They're not meant to live alone. And I guess the worst company you can ask for is yourself.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
I mean, that's all you've got for company is just you. You, your thoughts, your life, your past, your behavior, your actions. And, I mean, that's all you've got. And you're removed from all of the social and psychological crutches that keep everybody else normally, you know, keep you normal and keep you... human.
Let me quote something you wrote in a piece about dying in prison. You wrote, "Where was the redeeming value in fighting to exist so that one could exist only to suffer? If one's only mercy in this madness was to be death, why should one wait through a lifetime of pain before knowing the peace of the graveyard?" Did thoughts like that cross your mind when you were on death row?
What I was telling you about, you have to justify. If you've got a shred of decency about you, Terry, you're going to have to justify why you want to live. I mean, I'd hurt an awful lot of people. I'd hurt not only the victim and all of her relatives and people. I'd hurt my own family. I hurt myself. Not that it mattered with me, because while what I did was a crime, it was as much an act of suicide as it was criminal, because I didn't care what happened to me. And while I was on death row, you know, once I realized the gravity in an emotional way of what happened, you think about suicide, you think about killing yourself. And I came very close. I thought about it. But then, you know, I knew there was no, it's the coward's way out. You know, it's like not wanting to face the music. I did something wrong, and then I'm going to run from it. I mean, I wanted to redeem myself. You know, I did a criminal thing, but I wasn't as bad a person as that act may have implied.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Wilbert Rideau, who is the editor of The Angolite, which is the bimonthly news magazine of the Angola State Penitentiary in Louisiana. He's joining us by phone from the prison. His writings are collected in the new book, Life Sentences. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Wilbert Rideau, the editor of The Angolite, which is the bimonthly news magazine of Angola State Penitentiary in Louisiana. Was it on death row that you started writing?
I did. I started reading. I started writing. You have to understand, when I came here, the only literature they allowed you to have was religious literature and the Bible. That's it. If they caught you with any other type of literature or books, they put you in the dungeon on bread and water for 30 days. And it wasn't what people think. A lot of people have got this perception, this belief that, hey, they send you to prison, they try to rehabilitate you, you have all these opportunities and avenues by which to be rehabilitated, and that's not the case. When I came to prison, they used to punish you for education. There was no educational programs here. This was just a gigantic prison plantation, and you were sent here either to suffer or to be destroyed. One out of the two. That's it. There were no other reasons. Some of them were guards. They used to smuggle me books. And that's the way I got my education, on a catch-as-catch-can basis, you know, just in between the, depending on them to smuggle books to me and ducking the dungeon.
You must have had a good relationship with some of the guards, that they would take the risk required to smuggle books for you.
Well, actually, I've never really understood that, because you have to understand, I was black. The first thing they did when I came in here, since, you know, my victim was white, part of the processing was that it was automatically, you got a beating when you came to prison like that for any crime committed against a white person. This was back in the deep South in 1961. Everything was segregated, and we live in a world sharply divided by race. Remember, this is another generation, another era in time, not today. And that was part of that was the automatic processing. But then, and here at the prison, there were no black employees here. All employees and all authority were white. And they were like quite a few, most of them, I mean, let's face it, they were like the people you see in the movies about, you know, the typical Southern guard or, you know, chewing tobacco, and because most of them came from rural areas, and they had probably as much education, not much more education than I had. But for whatever reason, some of them saw something in me, I guess, worth saving or worth risking their own livelihood, their family's livelihood, their job, to smuggle books to me so that I could try to educate myself. They didn't do it to everybody.
What were the books that you were able to read that meant the most to you?
I've read about a library of books, but
I mean, while you were on death row.
Initially, some of the first books I've read was the Bible, because that's the first thing I had. And the first two books to make a big impression on me was, one was, I remember, Frank Yerbe's novel, Fair Oaks, about slavery in the South. And I never knew this. You know, you have to understand, I was a black living in the South, had been, you know, and I knew the South. I knew what life was like while I, you know, the life I live and the world I lived in, but I didn't know some of the things that went on, what slaves had to go through, and, you know, this is my history, and I didn't know that. I knew that they had a civil war to end slavery in, you know, in a very abstract way like most people did, but I didn't realize all this, and I read this book, and it blew my mind away. I was shocked. I mean, wow, really? And then I couldn't get enough to read, and then the next book, you know, the next book I read that impacted me was Atlas Shrugged by
Ayn Rand.
Right. And I guess those were the first two books, in addition to the Bible. Those three, really, are the first three books, and I can remember those three well. Those are the first three books to start affecting my thinking.
Now, how did reading lead to writing?
Well, it didn't. What happened was there was this desire on my part. Like I said, I'd committed an awful act, and an act that defined me as a criminal. And I wanted to redefine myself. I wanted to redeem myself. I wanted to show the world that, hey, I'm not as bad a person as I may have been. This crime, while it was committed by me, was not all of me. It wasn't the final definition of me. And I had this need to redeem myself, to do good, you know, to try to change things. And I guess, you know, at some point I realized, you know, there's no, you've got few avenues. You've got nothing, there's nothing you can do. That's the thing about your criminal justice system. You can be as remorseful, people always say be remorseful and make amends for what you did. You can be as remorseful as you want to be. You can be as well-intentioned as you want to be, and there are no avenues in your entire system to make amends. I mean, there just isn't any. So what you have to do is create it, and that's what I did. The only avenue I had was to write.
So you started writing, what, a journal or stories? What did you write at first, and was this still when you were on death row?
I wrote, I was trying to explain criminality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I was trying to explain criminality and how people become criminals, why, what they do. I mean, the whole psychology of it all. And a lot of it had to do with me. What I was going to do, I had no intention on publishing it. What I was going to do was just leave it with my lawyers and others for, you know, if I got executed or whatever, well, hey, that's, you know, that would be my legacy, as opposed to, you know, just the crime. I mean, I didn't want to leave a legacy of just, you know, I wanted to do good. I wanted to try to make amends.
Now, how did this lead to writing for The Angleite, the news magazine of the prison?
Well, after I got out of prison, after I finally managed to get off death row,
mm-hmm,
and rejoin society, my sentence was commuted to life. and I rejoined, I joined Prison Society. Well, what I didn't know was Prison Society consisted of the bloodiest prison in the nation. You know, I mean, in 1973, the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola was officially the bloodiest prison in the entire United States. Gangs ruled the prison, and it was a literal jungle. It was dog, you know, it was a place where the strong survived and ruled, and the weak either served as slaves or perished. And everybody had weapons. And, you know, in fact, when they was getting ready to put me in the rest of the population, the chief of security told me, that's the, you know, what would the first thing when you get down there, you know, if you don't have any friends, you need to get a weapon. You know, I mean, they told everybody that. That
was, well, how do you get a weapon when you're inside?
That's easy. I mean, you know, that's easy to do. If somebody wanted a weapon, not only in this prison, probably a whole lot of other prisons across the nation, if they wanted a weapon, they could probably have one very quickly. It's just that the question is, you know, if I wanted one, I could probably get one, but I don't want one.
So when you got off death row and were put into the general prison population, were you able to defend yourself?
Yeah. Well, the difference is that I had, when I got off death row, I was able to defend myself, but I had long ago determined that I would never, I'd hurt a person. I'd hurt people, you know, in that crime, and I was never going to hurt people again to the extent that I could avoid it. And I've been able to do that by exercising my mind to deal with problems as opposed to dealing with them in other ways. Subsequently, I've not had to hurt anybody as long as I've been in prison.
Wilbert Rideau edits The Angolite, the news magazine of the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. His articles are collected in the new book, Life Sentences. We'll continue our conversation in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Grosson. This is Fresh Air.